Last week, we began a series of lessons concerning a question that is paramount to all of us. And that question is, does God exist? The reason for our study is twofold. One, we need to be ready to give an answer to every man that asketh a reason concerning the hope that is within us. We look forward to a time when we are going to meet our God, we believe. We need to be able to answer the questions that those who are not of the same opinion have about our belief. And so, as I said last week, we're going to examine the basis for our belief in God. The very first question is, does God exist? And then we're going to examine the evidence, and this will be the second in that part of this series. The answer is either yes or no. If yes, then we can proceed further and we ask, does God reveal himself to man? Again, the answer is either yes or no. And we're going to examine the evidence for that in coming lessons. But if the answer is yes, then we proceed to ask, does God reveal himself through the Bible? And we're going to examine the evidence. We're going to look to see what is there that we can show others that would vindicate our faith in God? The answer is either yes or no. And then we're going to ask a question, is Jesus the Son of God? This is a question for each one of us to determine. We need to examine ourselves and search for these eternal truths. The very first thing that we looked at last time, and I'm not going to repeat the whole lesson, so don't worry about that. There were a series of slides coming up to this, and if you'd like those, they're available on our website. You can go and look at the PowerPoints. You can get the recordings in the back. And if you notice right here, if I move this little mouse around, you see the sun right out here. It's just a speck. The immensity of the universe, this is the Milky Way. Our galaxy, the galaxy in which we exist. And we are such a small and insignificant part of that. And so we have to ask ourselves, as science does, how did such an immense universe come from nothing? What caused it? Does the universe and all therein have meaning? And so we looked at, among other things, the anthropic principle. That is, the question is, there may be life on other worlds we don't know. We're not there, we can't say. But I can tell you something that is unique about this planet. Not just that there's a planet out there that's the right distance from the sun, the second of these, because if it's closer or further away, then there's not going to be any life on Earth because it's going to either roast or freeze. And then we think about the rotation of the Earth going around 24 hours. We all just set our clocks ahead. And as we think about that, we say, well, is that part of God's plan? And indeed it is, because we have summer and winter. We have springtime and fall. And we find that because of this, our life on this earth is adapted. Its rotation is perfect for this. The size of the sun that it's around, the star to which we look, is also important. And we find that our world just happens to fit all of these things. Now, you may be like somebody who says, well, that's just a happy circumstance. Stay with us. The slant of the earth at 23 degrees. And you sit there and you say, well, what's important about that? Well, it turns out again that if it were not that way, that we would not have the seasons that we do. And we would not have the rotational pull that we have on the earth. The distance of the moon to the earth, though, is additionally important. Because we have tides. You know, up in the Bay of Fundy, tides are 12 feet difference between high and low. And you look out to the Chesapeake and, oh, it's only a few feet. And you get down to the center of the earth, the equator, and it's even less. And you say, well, what would happen if the moon were closer and its gravitational pull were greater on the mass of the oceans? Well, you can imagine what a 50-foot tide would do to New York City, or even Washington, D.C., as you think about the inundation that would take place. The thickness of the earth crust. Now I'll try to say it very clearly this time. We have oxides, and they are formed in the mantle. And if it were thicker and it took up more oxygen to make those oxides, it's a chemical situation. You think of it as rust. Okay, when an iron bar rusts, that's iron going to iron oxide. That's a chemical process. And that's what's happened in our crust. But if our crust were any thicker, we wouldn't have enough free oxygen here. If it were any thinner, we would have too much. And then we think about our atmosphere. And we realize how wonderful it is. Have you ever been in a place where there was too much carbon dioxide and you start seeing people go to sleep? Or carbon monoxide, which will put them to sleep permanently. And you think about, well, what if there were more of that in the air? We'd be in trouble, wouldn't we? There are these things, and you know, just 2, 4, 6, 7 things. And you say, how much could they be off by? And you start looking at it and you say, somebody precisely planned this. You can say that it happened by chance, but if you are one of those who plays games of chance, you start to realize very soon, this is not a probable conclusion. And then we ask ourselves, are there hundreds of millions of planets in the universe where life exists? I still remember in the 60s when they came out to New Mexico and on the Magdalena Plains out there, they put out a radio telescope array and they said, we will search for extraterrestrial life. 55 years ago. We're pretty good at this. We haven't found any yet, but you know, you got to give those folks at NASA credit. They just don't give up, do they? They're still hunting. They're still saying, support us, we'll find it. Sooner or later, we'll find it. It's not prevalent in the universe, is it? And then we started thinking about the likelihood of man occurring as a random chance in a huge cesspool of debris. You know, that's what you're looking at. You're looking at garbage and you're saying, well, out of this garbage came man. And as you start to see these evolutionary platforms that men dream up based on natural selection, you say, things never happened that way in my life. I had a good friend that in college, he was an engineering major and I was a chemistry major. So we were in the lab one night, I was making up some stuff and he said, can I play with these chemicals that are sitting here? And I said, yes, just don't kill yourself. He said, well, I like to mix them and see what happens. And he would get in and he would take the things off the shelf and he would mix them. And every time he got a brown goo. Nothing ever came out of that mess. It was completely unplanned. Eb didn't know how to plan a good experiment. He was just throwing things together. When you throw things together, what you get is a big mess in chemistry or in anything else. When you start thinking, was there an intelligent designer? And I showed you some slides. And by the way, those are available. If you'd like to have those, I can send them to you. But you'll hear those who scoff and say it must have been by the theory of natural selection, by what they ate. But what's the probability? This is where the new part starts for those of you who are wondering. Sir Frederick Hoyle, who was a famous astronomer, an atheist to his dying day, calculated this, and he says the probability of cellular life evolving was about 1 in 10 to the 40,000th. That's a 1 in a 10 with a 1 with 40,000 zeros out there. And I messed it up last time, didn't I? Some of you caught me. I said, oh yeah, they're looking. Said, yeah, you said there were 6 zeros in a billion, but there are 9 zeros in a billion. Good catch, folks. Because you sit there and you say, well, what are my chances of winning the lottery this week? Well, 1 in a billion. Maybe it's 1 in 100 million. And you say, well, does that mean I'm going to get it? You look at all those people lining up. They're just all sure they're going to be the ones. And guess what? They're not. The government runs those things to fleece the public. You may enjoy playing them, but I will tell you they're there so that they can get money that you will give up willingly instead of paying it in taxes. Some of you. Hopefully none of you. Hopefully you're smarter than that. Your chances of winning are minuscule. But let me tell you, they're not as minuscule. That number is so small that it's impossible. I tell this story, and it's not on the slides, but The first class in physical chemistry that I took as I began work on my doctorate in chemistry, professor walked into class and he said, "There is a probability that all the air in this room is suddenly going to rush to that back corner and we're all going to suffocate." And I thought immediately, that idiot is going to make us calculate it. He's going to give us a bunch of numbers and he's going to make us calculate that. That's ridiculous. The air in this room is never going to rush to that back corner and we're all going to suffocate. And I was pleased to hear him say in his next breath, "But that probability is so vanishingly small that we believe it to be zero and we take no notice of it." I was so relieved. But can you imagine? What is the probability that all the air in this room is going to suddenly rush to that corner? And all of you look there and say, "That's not the way air works. You've learned it in school. You know, that's not the way air works. You've learned it from practical experience." So Sir Frederick Hoyle said, "The chance that higher life forms might have emerged in this way is comparable to the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein." What did he come up with? I don't go into it in this lesson any further. He said panspermia. He said there were some ancient astronauts, he didn't say where they came from, that went through the universe and they just spread bacterial life forms and stuff around, and so that's what we evolved from. He didn't answer the question, did he? He just put it back a few million or 100 million years in his mind. He died as an atheist because he just couldn't believe that Earth and life as we know it could come about from nothing. He says life as we know it is, among other things, dependent on at least 2,000 different enzymes. Now, those are those little catalysts. You have catalytic converters that keeps the gases that come out of your car from coming out and being so nasty. And an enzyme is just a biological catalyst. It makes one thing go to another. And so he says there are 2,000 enzymes, and they'll go in and they'll look at your enzymes from time to time. You may say, "Well, I've got my blood work here, and it's got an alkaline phosphatase. What is that?" I say, "Oh, that's a liver enzyme." And I tell people that call me up, "You don't have to worry about that one with my stuff. That's not kidney, that's liver." Okay? But there are 2,000 of these things, and they're what keep you running. God has designed them. In fact, He has designed them so perfectly that in the niche that they fill, scientists says we can't tinker with those things and make them do any better. They're all maximized for what they're doing. And so Sir Frederick Hoyle says there are 2,000 different enzymes. Think if you had to play poker with a deck of 2,000 cards. Think you can count that many? And think if each of those cards had two different ways that they could appear. And that enzyme, however long it was, could be filled by any one of those. And you say, you know, you'd have to work a long time to figure that out. How could the blind forces of the primal sea manage to put together the correct chemical elements to build enzymes? He couldn't answer that, and no one else can either. I will assure you, it doesn't happen by chance. As we showed you in the slideshow last week, God has made things so wonderful. You look at the hand, any child's hand, and you look at it and you say, "This is wonderfully and fearfully made. I can apply pressure just slight enough that I can pick up a pea and not crush it." And I will assure you that that is a feat that as yet our engineers haven't mastered. Hoyle was an atheist and a Darwinist, and he said that the apparent suggestion of a guiding hand left him greatly shaken. I am reminded of a king who told the Apostle Paul, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. Go thy way for this time, and when I have a convenient season, I'll call on thee." Do you wonder at the hour of his death whether he thought about this? I have quoted before for many of you, but listen carefully. A famous atheist in the last century named Ingersoll is said to have pronounced on his deathbed, "O God, if there be a God, save my soul, if I have a soul, from hell, if there be a hell. That man was really convinced, wasn't he? Please, if you're really there, and I really have a soul, and there really is a hell, you please take care of me. That must have made God feel really benevolent toward him, don't you think? And you sit there and you say, God says that those who come to him must diligently seek him. Hoyle didn't want to accept the obvious. Evolution by natural selection fails to account for the characteristics that man possesses which are completely unknown to the animals. I've told you before, I have this little dog. Many of you have seen that little Jack Russell running around out there on the farm. And as I go out there and I look to the skies and I contemplate the beauty of the sky, and Sandy and I will sometimes say, look at that sunset. You know what we say, what happens to the dog if we say that to him? He turns around and he does a dance and he stands up and he looks at me and says, please give me something more to eat. That's all he wants. He wants a treat. He'll do circles. He'll sit down. He'll do anything for a treat if you'll just take a little bit of time for him. Except he doesn't appreciate the sunsets. Man has the capacity for complex, rational thought. Man has a sense of morals. You know, my dog doesn't punish somebody else for doing something wrong. May get mad at him if they try to eat something that he thinks is his. But that's it. In all societies of man, there are moral codes about murder and incest. They kick people out of the tribe, even in the worst nations. You can kill somebody else, but don't you kill one of us. And then you think about this aesthetic nature. Inherent in man is the capacity to appreciate the beautiful and harmonious. I don't see that. You know, we were out walking around yesterday in the pasture. Tremendous amount of snow out there, and there's a goat. You know, the goat is out there in that cold. And he could look at the sunset and care less. What he wants is food. That's it. The cattle that are out there, the same thing. And yet, in your homes, some of you will grow orchids. My wife likes those things. She has a bunch of different ones. She just thinks they're wonderful. My wife is an artist. She used to paint things before she got too busy with other things. Beautiful paintings. Some of you have seen some of them hanging in our home. My dog has never done that. You may say, well, they have paintings that are made by elephants now. Yes, if you'll give them something, they'll swish it around. But they're not intentionally painting anything. And so you think about, there's something within man that's not present within any other of the animal kingdom. You just don't find it. Again, I want you to think about man being inherently religious. My dog doesn't appear to me to be able to sit there and contemplate what his purpose in life is. His purposes are pretty simple. Eat. Wag your tail. Make somebody happy so they'll give you something. But even primitive civilizations, as we know them, had a sense of a higher being, a basic fear of death, a conception of life after death, and a form of worship. You just go back a couple of thousand years, and you can see that such things happen all over the globe. There are people who have decided, well, in these high trees, the redwood forests of California, there is a beauty that must mean that God is there. And there are others who will take various forms of dances. You know, recently out in the West, there are a lot of Indians out there, and we have some Indian blood in our family. And so I look at these things, and, you know, there are things that they scratch on the stones and such. And they'll say, well, they're Indian hieroglyphics. They're something like what the Egyptians did. They scratch things on there. And I think those are all mainly Kilroy was here. That is, he was there. This is my sign. But some of those, they're thinking about something bigger than us. Is there something? Every society on earth has sat down and they've tried to come up with Where do we come from? How is it that we are here? And then I want you to think about conscience and shame. There are people who in which shame disappears. You'll see some of the artists. In fact, Daryl sent me an article about Janis Joplin the other day. It turns out that she was raised by those who loved the Lord. And she didn't feel very loved and got into drugs and a bunch of other things. She was at one time a member of the Church of our Lord. But if you know about her, she's a famous singer. She got into the drug scene. She did everything. And yet, from time to time, they are conscience stricken. Why am I doing this? How is it that I'm treating other people the way I'm treating them? Each one of you, to some degree, sees outrage when you see a child being threatened or beaten or hurt in any way. You just sat there and said, that shouldn't be allowed. We need to take the person who did that and put them away so that they cannot harm society. But man's mind and his surroundings show an innate reluctance to take the life of another. You have to work to get someone to be mean enough to kill someone. You have to really work at it. I still remember the first time that an experiment, I was trained as a chemist, and I got here to Baltimore and I had to kill a rat. I needed the lungs. And I said, how am I going to get these lungs? And the technician smiled and said, take this rod and hit the rat in the head. You ever tried that? Take a rat. You know, he's sitting there. You know, I'm just going to whack that rat and kill him. How did you like it the first time? My wife says when she was a little girl, they had to get chickens on the farm. And she was not big enough to wring their head. My grandmother would take a chicken by the head and swing it around twice and whip it. The chicken would go out there and the head would be off and blood would be everywhere. My grandson just looked at his grandma. She couldn't do that. That was my grandmother. His grandmother went out and she put the chicken's head underneath the hoe handle and pulled on the feet because she was smaller until she pulled the chicken's head off. And there are people who are sitting out here, Max especially right now, saying, you didn't have to say that. That's sickening. He always does that to me. It is. Can you imagine sending your child out, go out and catch that goose that's out there, and then you pull its head off? And your kid's going to look at you like, you must be joking. It's hard to do that. My dog doesn't mind it at all. He finds any of those things out there, and I'll assure you that if he can catch them, they're going to be dead shortly, and he's going to be eating them. It doesn't matter whether it's a mouse, a snake. I've seen two dogs worry a snake from both ends until they killed it. But you know, people just don't inherently have it in them to do that. It has to be taught to them by others. But I want to tell you that there are two things that these marks of personality prove. One, that man was created in the image of a personal God with those same qualities of intellect, free will, moral sense, and was not the product of so-called resident forces of the material universe. In fact, if you want to know what one of the greatest things that scientists are worrying about, that is, those who are in artificial intelligence, you've seen it in the news lately. We're worried, what will happen when machines take over the world? The very greatest minds who are looking at this saying, what will happen when the machines finally are able to make their own decisions and they don't make them according to moral forces? Well, let me see, that would be evolution, wouldn't it? You immediately understand that if there are no moral forces guiding us, if there is no God, what's wrong with a decision that a machine might make if it happens to cause your life to be taken? After all, it was indiscriminate. We don't like indiscriminate murderers. We don't like people. We want reason. We want rationale. We are people who have a mind based on our God, and we have morals. We understand that we don't go out and bash our children's heads against the wall. We don't feed our children to the fire. You know, that's what they used to do. Take firstborn, take him out there and feed him to the gods. Let him be burned. We call that paganism. So I want to tell you that there's something in you that is not material. For some reason, you have these thoughts in you that are not based upon logic. They're not based upon, I can see why these things are so good for us. Stephen Hawking, a brilliant theoretical physicist. I want to read to you from Darwin's Descent of Man, the 1874 edition. These are on pages 149 and 150. They've been left out of some later editions because people got ashamed of this. With savages, the weakened body or mind are soon eliminated, and those that survive commonly exhibit a vigorous state of health. We civilized men, this is Darwin speaking, back in 1874, on the other hand, do our utmost to check the progress of elimination. We build asylums for the imbecile, the maimed, and the weak. We institute poor laws. Our medical experts exert their utmost skill to save lives of everyone to the last moment. There is reason to believe that vaccination has preserved thousands who from weak constitutions would have succumbed to smallpox. You get the drift of what this guy is saying? Let them die. They're weak. They're not as fit for survival. That's what this says. Thus, the weak members of civilized societies propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man. He is saying that some of you shouldn't be allowed to breed because you're inferior. Of course, he was going to be on the top of the heap. And you think about that, and this man, sitting in that chair, believes in that until it comes to him. You ask yourself, how could such a brilliant man not comprehend the evil that resides in the theory of natural selection, the survival of the fittest? Hitler believed it. Hitler was going to make the perfect race. Let's get rid of all the Jews. But he didn't stop there. He also said all the Poles. And he said all the blacks. You should read sometime about the 1936 Olympics. I'll guarantee you. You sit there and say, Jim Thorpe was a mighty runner. I want you to let the implications of such things sink in. All of the sickening cruelty of heathen societies, survival of the fittest, all of the stench of Hitler's master race ovens are wrapped up in what Darwin concluded. And there's no reason to doubt it if there is no God. When you think about ethics, you are looking to the God of heaven to say, give us a guide. But that guide is innately placed in every society of man until someone who is evil enough comes along and tries to do away with it. Evolutionists, Hawking including. I'll tell you, when you say this, a fellow who is a president of the National of the Texas Academy of Science, a biologist by training, thought that they ought to just take away all the people who lived in Texas and turn that into a vast preserve for animals because the people didn't deserve it, the animals did, they were there first. You know how he was going to get rid of the people? He thought they ought to be willing to euthanize themselves. Of course, he was going to move out of state. If man is just a superior form of animal life, why not selective breeding to improve the strain? You know, you look around and you say, there are clearly some people who have more brains than others. There are some people who have more might than others. Why not? Let's make a master race here. And each of you, when you start thinking about that, said, this is sickening. We all have a place in our society. There is something for each of us, just as there is in the church. And when you start thinking about the fact that I think my family should breed and yours shouldn't, you have put yourself in the place of God. Why should moral, religious, or sociological factors even enter into the picture? One of the hardest questions for the evolutionists is if a man is just a higher animal, why is it wrong to kill a man but not wrong to kill a deer or a chicken? You know, the thing I miss most about my current diet is fried chicken. Fried chicken is just, Craig might say it's a steak or a spare rib. I'll tell you what I miss most. It's fried chicken. Why is it wrong? You know, if you go out there now, you'll see the lobbyists from PETA. That's People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And they don't want you to go to McDonald's and have it your way. I guess that's someplace else. Burger King. And as you start thinking about it, you sit there and you say, well, all right, why is it that I can eat a chicken or a pig or a cow or a fish and it's not wrong? And you understand that God has given them to us for our food. However, I will tell you that even among the evolutionists, they're having problems with this bunch at PETA, especially in Europe. Because they don't want them testing vaccines on monkeys first. They want to test them on you, on your children. They want to see if your children, don't mistreat the animals. You want to see if a drug is toxic? Try it on your child. Think of how many people wouldn't go into science if that had to happen every time. It'll be the scientist's children that these things get tried on first. And you'll have no idea of whether they're toxic or not. And you understand that there is a difference between the mind of man and the mind of the animals. There's a different place. The atheist must deny his own nature to say that the strongest should purge the weakest. I have never yet met an atheist who said, well, yeah, we can kill my grandmother first or my mother first. We have too many people in the world. I'm going to shoot myself. They may say that, but they won't say, I'll tell you what, I'll just kill my kids. You say, no. That can't happen. There are implications that say that we rise above the brute forces of what some people call nature. Somebody asked yesterday, what is Mother Nature? That's a euphemism for people who know there's a God and don't want to say that there's a God. They're afraid they might offend someone. The atheist is completely incapable of proving that natural selection leads to new genera. I'm not talking about new species. I worked with a fellow once said, oh, you can get gray squirrels and black squirrels in less than 40 years on opposite sides of the mountain. Why? Because the squirrel never did cross over the mountain. They're not different. They just selected certain things, and they're different colors on the sides of the mountains. And this is something that we have to deal with in our society as we look, well, what has to be preserved? But I will assure you that there is no genera, there's no skipping of the kinds that the Bible talks about. Even though you may blast them with huge doses of radiation or chemical agents that change their DNA, you don't get genera skips. You get a difference within what you started with. And I want to point out that the atheist closes his mind to all the evidence God has written into his creation. How can you look at the Milky Way and say, it just happened? How can you look at a child that is so exquisitely formed as it comes forth from the womb and say, it just happened? Atheism cannot be proved, and I will tell you that it's morally bankrupt. They may say, we have morals. You've picked them up from us, from believers in God. Atheists have no reason to be moral. Agnosticism, which is saying, well, I don't know if there is a God, is cowardly, refusing to make a decision. Agnosticism, we just don't know, leaves one without a moral standard, without hope, with sorrow that this life is the best one will ever know, and with no one to care unless they receive a reward for caring. As you grow older in life, one of the things that you're going to wonder is, does anyone care? What have you done in this life that would cause others to miss you? What kind of person are you? God tells us that we are to be the kind of people that emulate Him. I want you to think for just a moment about how much God gave us. God is the only reasonable explanation for the order, the design, and the purpose of this vast universe, and the origin and the personality of man. I have known some people that were so caring in my lifetime, but then I think of biblical examples. I think of Dorcas, and the ladies were showing what she had done for others. I think of Barnabas and what he had done for others. I think of the Apostle Paul and how he had spent his life preaching to others. And I think, is there anything that they're going to remember us for. And of course, if there is no hope in this world, if atheism or agnosticism is correct, then there's no reason to be a kind and good and caring person. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 25, the Lord says, "To whom will you compare me, or who is my equal?" says the Holy One. "Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing." We're going to examine next week the question of, does God reveal himself to man? But I want you to consider, just as we close here, the possibility that he does reveal himself, and that it is through the Bible. Here's the situation that each of us is facing, young and old. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets, in many portions, in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. For this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? If you're here this morning, I want you to think about it. How will you escape? You may confidently say, these things that he's been teaching are not true, but if they are, let me tell you, I will have only wasted a few hours doing things that I've enjoyed with my brethren. And you, on the other hand, will have lost your soul for all eternity. That's the choice between looking at the Scriptures and deciding to do his will, or deciding to go your own way. If you're here this morning and you haven't been obedient to the gospel of Jesus Christ, I would encourage you to think carefully about your salvation. If there's any way in which we can help you in rendering obedience, won't you let us know while together we stand and we sing.